Hello and welcome to the podcast edition of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, reviews, previews, and interviews with authors and artists about baseball books, music, film, pretty much anything you can fit on a bookshelf. And that's the slogan, if it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. Lou Gehrig, Jackie Robinson, two of the game's most iconic players, celebrated for their courage under extreme conditions. Both subjects of outstanding biographies by today's guest Jonathan Eig, and both of which appear in 501 Baseball Books Fans Must Read Before They Die. Eig has worked as a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, Chicago Magazine, the Dallas Morning News, and the New Orleans Times-Picayune. His work has also appeared in the New York Times, Esquire, and the Washington Post, and he has appeared on Today Show, NPR, and in the Prohibition documentary made by Ken Burns for PBS. But what really impresses people is that he once appeared on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, although that was to discuss his biography on Al Capone, who did have some baseball connections himself. I've chatted with Jonathan Eig several times since The Luckiest Man came out in 2005. Here's our latest conversation. Jonathan Eig, welcome back to the Baseball Bookshelf.
Thanks, Ron. Good to talk to you again.
So you have Luckiest Man, The Life and Death of Lou Gehrig, and Opening Day, The Story of Jackie Robinson's First Season. These are probably two of the most iconic and courageous players in all of sports history. How did you decide on them as opposed to anyone else you might have chosen for your subjects?
I think it comes from the fact that I was never really a sports writer. I love sports, and I've written about it from time to time, but I've always made my living writing about other things, and to write about sports, I had to think about stories that were not entirely sports themed. Sports stories that had something bigger going on is what interested me. And it started out from reading Seabiscuit and just loving it, and realizing that sports books could be so multi-layered, and they didn't have to be all about the games. And from Seabiscuit, I just began thinking, well, who are the other sports figures that really had a major cultural impact? And the first one that came to mind was Lou Gehrig, just that, it's really a story about a man dying in his prime, and he happens to be a baseball player. And that's what got me going, writing baseball books, just because, I thought it would be fun to try to take what I love, which is baseball, and find ways to tell bigger stories that go beyond baseball, and that's kind of been my goal since then. And the same obviously applies to Robinson. If anything, his cultural impact was far greater than Gehrig's. The challenge there was that a lot had been written about Gehrig already. I mean, about Robinson already. So I had to see if there was anything new to say and whether I could find a different way into that story. So that was the challenge for Robinson. But I think, in terms of why I chose those subjects, I was looking for big stories as well as compelling sports stories.
Now I'll get back to Robinson in a minute, but you also had a hand. Lou Gehrig obviously had ALS. You had a hand in another book about ALS. What was that about?
Oh, I contributed a foreword to a book about a woman who was diagnosed with ALS, and it was called I Remember Running, and it was about how what ALS had taken so much away from her, and yet, like Gehrig, she refused to let the disease define her, and continued to live the biggest, strongest life she could with whatever time she had left. And I was really moved by the book and honored to add a small foreword to that one.
Did you find, having written the Gehrig book, that you're becoming somewhat of a voice for ALS?
Yeah, and I'm really thrilled about that. I mean, it's a terrible, terrible disease, but it's also called an orphan disease. It doesn't get the kind of attention that some other ailments receive because it doesn't hit that many people, and those who are hit by it don't live very long. And there are no survivors, so you don't have a community of survivors out there for ALS the way you do have for cancers, various cancers. There's always these survivors out there who are advocating to find cures and to raise money for support patients, but that doesn't exist with ALS. So I've been really honored to sort of, I think, pick up the job that Lou Gehrig left behind, and that is to, you know, continue to raise awareness about ALS and to fight for more money for research and to support patients who are struggling with the terrible disease.
Now, segueing into research and getting back to the baseball, Gehrig's book's a full bio. Robinson's focuses on one season. Between the two, which provided a bigger research challenge for you?
I think the Gehrig book was the more difficult one, just because he lived further back in time, and there weren't too many people alive to talk to. I think I found 30 ball players when I started doing my research who were still alive, who had overlapped with Gehrig and had met him or played with him, but nobody who really knew him intimately. So, and Gehrig was so shy that he didn't really leave behind a lot of evidence of his life. He never wrote an autobiography. He didn't write very many personal letters, and those letters that he did write were not very revealing. So his was the tougher life to research. You know, for Jackie Robinson, I had Jack's wife, Rachel, who's still very much alive and well and was an amazing resource, who was able to tell me so much about their lives together. And, of course, there were plenty of ballplayers still alive who knew Robinson pretty well. His children are still alive. Gehrig had no children. So the Gehrig research was definitely more difficult.
And putting both of these books together, and then your other books, you have Get Capone, The Secret Plot That Captures America's Most Wanted, and you have a new book coming out about the birth of the pill. When do you decide you have enough information to go forward and complete the manuscript?
Well, you never have enough information. I could keep researching forever.
But there does come a point where you have to stop.
Yeah, sure. Usually it's when I have a deadline. but, you know, the real trick is, when do you have enough to decide that you want to write the book? Because I'll spend months researching topics, trying to decide whether this is worthy of a book and whether it's interesting enough to sustain me for, you know, 2 or 3 years, and whether I think it'll find an audience. And that's the really hard part, because you go through a lot of ideas and you get excited about them, and more often than not, you decide to cut the cord and abandon it, and only the very best, you know, make it through that process and survive. And those are the so far the four books that I've decided were worth writing. That's, to me, the most challenging part. Once I commit to the book and I dive in and I research the life and I begin thinking about writing it, it's a lot less pressure. That's where it's more fun once I know that I'm actually going to do the book and I'm going to write it. But I still could research forever. You can never exhaust these subjects.
Do you find, which part do you find you enjoy more, the research part or the actual writing?
Oh, geez, it's hard to say, because they're inseparable. You can't really write without doing research. At least I can't. I have to have the raw materials. And the quality of the writing is directly related to the quality and the amount of research that I do. So the better the research, the more I have to tell, the better the story I have to tell, and the easier it is to write. So it's very hard for me to separate them.
Can you pick out one thing that surprised you from each of the two baseball books?
Oh, there's so many things. You know, with Gehrig, I guess, you know, for me the big revelation was that he wrote these letters when he was dying, and nobody had ever seen them before. They were in the hands of an autograph collector. They had never been published. They had never been publicized. And it was a huge shock and thrill to discover that Gehrig had put his words and his thoughts on paper after he was diagnosed with this fatal disease. And then, of course, to see the content of those letters and to see how brave he was and how strong he was, all that was you know, just mind-boggling to me. And, you know, coming across those letters for the first time was, you know, a feeling that I'll never forget. It was, you know, one of the great thrills of my career. For Robinson, I think it was getting to know Rachel and seeing just how stressful their lives were. You know, we have this image of Robinson being this strong, stoic guy who, you know, in 1947 stood up for what was right and turned the other cheek. But when you get down to it, and you get inside their lives, and you spend some time with Rachel, you see that he was really on a tightrope. It was a very perilous position he was in, and it was not this great dramatic historical moment to them. It was this incredibly tense, year of being really uncertain and insecure about their future. And they were a young couple with a baby, a newborn, and they didn't know how long this job was going to last. They didn't know if the experiment was going to fail. They were, living in miserable conditions. That was the surprise to me. And that's one of the things I love about this business is when you take this business of writing these historical stories, you take something that you think you know, something that's been glossed over so much by mythology, and you make it real, and you get inside their lives, and get inside that little apartment where they were living, and you see that they were just a young couple in love and trying something new that nobody had done before, and it was incredibly exciting but also scary. So seeing that through her eyes and getting to tell that story was really eye-opening for me.
How did you discover the existence of the Garrig letters?
Just sort of dumb luck / good reporting. One of the things I wanted to do is just get details that would bring Garrig to life. I wanted to know what size shoes he wore or what kind of car he drove and what he kept in his wallet, any little details that I could get. And obviously, baseball memorabilia collectors love that stuff. So I just went through every baseball memorabilia catalog that I could find, and I found some collectors who had catalogs going back 20 years, and I flipped through every page of every one of those catalogs just looking for anything that was Garrig-related. So I found, canceled checks. I found old shoes, old hats, passports, keychains, and in one of those catalogs, I found some letters that he wrote to his doctor, and you couldn't read them in the catalog, and I had no idea how many of them there were. It took me about 6 months to figure out who owned the letters, who had purchased them at the auction, and then it took me even longer to convince him to share those letters with me and let me see them. And then, once I did, it was an amazing moment.
So, better movie, The Pride of the Yankees or the Jackie Robinson story?
Oh, my God. The original Jackie Robinson story, you mean, not the new one that just came out last year. I think they're both pretty dreadful. I'm not a fan of either movie. I think that they're both a big missed opportunity. The Garrig movie, obviously, is the more popular of the two, and it was a big success at the box office and won awards, and far more people have seen that that Garrig movie, Pride of the Yankees. But it's so sappy, and Garrig just doesn't really come across as Garrig to me in that movie. Gary Cooper portrays him as this, very bland, wimpy kind of a guy, and Garrig was not a wimp. It upsets me to see him portrayed that way. And the Robinson movie was okay. Robinson's not much of an actor. He portrayed himself. Right. So it's pretty corny, and it's full of cliches, and it doesn't really take history very seriously. But that's Hollywood. They don't really care about the facts.
And what about 42?
42, again, they didn't really respect the history. They didn't set out to tell the story accurately.
Well, they always preface the movie with based on a true story.
Yeah, based on a true story. They also,
There was a person named Jackie Robinson. There was a person named
Yeah, they got the characters were accurately named. It was a pretty good movie, I thought. My biggest complaint was just that Robinson came off a little bit two-dimensional. I really would have liked to have seen them make him more subtle and more nuanced. And he didn't feel like a real person to me. I thought Branch Rickey was a far better developed character in the film than Robinson was. He ended up feeling something when Rickey was on the screen, but Robinson, it was a little too Disney-fied for me. I understand why they did that, because they want to appeal to the broadest possible audience, but I would have liked to have seen how Spike Lee or somebody else would have directed it and made Robinson a little more angry, a little bit more human.
He seemed pretty angry in the movie to me.
Yeah, but it's all this... it just didn't feel like genuine anger to me. It felt like, you know,
movie
Hollywood anger. Like, did he ever have a bad day? Did he ever, you know, have a fight with his wife? Did he ever, you know, act the way, you know, a normal person would act, as opposed to just sort of this, you know, this heroic film character? I didn't feel it in the movie, but it was entertaining. I my kids liked it too. I mean, it had a lot going for it. Just, you know, maybe I'm biased. I hold these things up to ridiculous standards.
Well, when I went to see it, I saw it a couple of times. When I went to see it, the first time was in shortly after it came out. There's a very mixed audience. There were older people and younger people and a lot of African-American people. And I happened to be sitting in front of two African-American women. And I could hear them commenting on certain aspects of the movie. So that I found that a very interesting situation, as opposed to the second time when I saw it in a much more homogeneous audience, older white people. And to hear the different, to feel the different atmosphere while you're watching it.
Yeah, and I'm sure it, you know, it resonated with a lot of people, and I think that it's great to keep that message out. You know, baseball has, and that's the other thing. It was, you know, they had the blessings of Major League Baseball, so they had to sort of sanitize it to a certain extent. But baseball has done a great job of promoting its history, and especially its history on the civil rights front. And I give them a lot of credit for that. It's great that we're still celebrating Jackie Robinson every April 15th, and that ballparks all around the country are reminding Americans of the game's history. You know, I think that's wonderful.
All right. Speaking of history, another good segue. This is the 100th anniversary of Wrigley Field, so there are a lot of books coming out to mark that occasion. Now, one of these that I just finished is The Cubs Quotient, How the Chicago Cubs Changed the World. And it has a couple of entries about the relationship between the Cubs and Al Capone, which is the subject of another one of your books. So, and of course, there's that famous scene in The Untouchables where Robert De Niro, as Capone, talks about the teamwork principles of baseball just before he bashes the brains out of one of his dinner guests. Now, you published, obviously, you did the Capone book. Was there any baseball issues in Capone's, in your version of Capone?
No, Capone loved sports, and he loved to gamble. So he, you know, he went to the racetrack, and he had some ownership stakes in some racetracks, and he liked going to football and baseball games. But I don't really know of any meaningful interactions that he had with the Cubs, other than as a fan. He did get photographed one time with Gabby Hartnett, and the commissioner of baseball sent a note to Hartnett telling him, you know, please don't be hanging around Al Capone. I don't want to see your picture with him in the paper again. But other than that, I don't really know of any real stories, or certainly any accurate stories that tie Capone to the Cubs. I'd be curious. I haven't read the book, so I don't know what he says in there.
Mm-hmm. So you've got the Capone book. Your new book is The Birth of the Pill, How Four Crusaders Reinvented Sex and Launched a Revolution. Is there another baseball book in your future?
I don't know. I'd love to do another baseball book. I am going to do a sports book again. After The Pill, my next book, I'm going to be doing the biography of Muhammad Ali. So I'm really excited to get back to sports. I think this is the biggest sports story that we have in this country. Ali's story is, as I said earlier, I look for the stories that have cultural resonance that go beyond the games or the bouts, and Ali certainly is a great one for that.
And we've been talking with Jonathan Eig, author of Luckiest Men, The Life and Death of Lou Gehrig, and Opening Day, The Story of Jackie Robinson's First Season. Jonathan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that does it for another podcast edition of the Baseball Bookshelf. I just want to mention a personal note. I was a guest on Greg Rashid's Root and Roots Blog Talk Radio program last week. I'll post a link to that up on the Baseball Bookshelf site. It was a fun conversation. Greg really knows his stuff, and I appreciate him having me on. So tune in again soon. Future guests on this baseball podcast will include Jonah Carey, author of the new definitive history of the Montreal Expos, and Dan Epstein, who takes another nostalgic look at baseball in the 1970s. And remember to visit Ron Kaplan's baseball bookshelf regularly. Remember, we have a new book week giveaway. Be the fifth commenter to leave a remark on any topic from the baseball bookshelf, and you can win. You get a book, and I get to clean up the house. So there's that. So thanks again, everybody, and we'll see you soon. Said, boys, I'm glad I discovered this land. Cheers.